The Bradshaw Arts Hour on Wandsworth Radio, where you listen with your ears and not your mouth.
Good evening, everyone, and you're listening to Wandsworth Radio. We are the Bradshaw Arts Hour, and we're taking you all the way through this evening to 7 o'clock. We have loads of stuff coming up on the show this week. We've got a lot of poetry. We have an interview with the new Bradshaw production coming up, and we have another review from something you might remember from last week. We did an interview about a production called Great Expectations, and we reviewed it. Ellie and I went and saw it on Friday evening. Ellie's with me in the studio.
Hello.
Hi, Ellie. Also with me this evening is Matt again.
Hello.
Matt's going to be reviewing a film shortly. What have we all been up to this week, guys? Anything interesting in the arts scene?
Well, as you say, I went and saw Great Expectations with you Friday night, which was pretty much as much excitement as I can take on a Friday. So
yeah,
that was well
pretty
received.
Exciting.
It was very exciting.
Matt, anything to report?
Quiet week for me so far, but I am going to be ducking out of the show early to go and see Kate Tempest in Brixton.
You are so art, Matt.
I love the way you say that, like it. You're just hanging out just with Kate Tempest, just on a date maybe.
Oh yeah, yeah, just going off and chilling.
Yeah,
that sounds
nice.
Very intimate. Lovely. But first up, we are going to do this.
The Matt Boothman Film Review. So good, I put my trousers back on.
Oh, Matt. Oh, dear.
So we've both seen this week's film.
Yes, we have, unfortunately.
don't spoil
okay,
your
sorry.
Opinion.
I'm sorry. Proceed.
we've both been to see Jupiter Ascending this week, which is the new movie by the Wachowskis of The Matrix and Speed Racer and Cloud Atlas fame. This is the first original sci-fi script they've done since The Matrix movies, so they've all done adaptations since then. So the movie in a nutshell, Mila Kunis is an illegal immigrant to the USA. She works as a maid cleaning toilets, and then Channing Tatum shows up on his space rollerblades and reveals that she is the queen of space. And she has to go to space and try to survive among all of her slimy space relatives. That about sum it up?
Yep, that is as good as it's going to get, I think, because that is essentially the plot.
Yeah, so I think I said last week that I was hoping for this movie to be bonkers.
Mm-hmm.
I think what it actually is silly.
Mm.
So to me, bonkers means there's a sort of a level of inventiveness and a level of originality to it. And while the design of it is hugely inventive, like the look of the spaceships and the look of the guns and the aforementioned space roller skates are all pretty cool. And Channing Tatum's facial hair
is
interesting as well.
Just his whole, like,
his whole
the way
look.
He looks. And the fact that he just didn't wear a shirt for a good portion of the film. Like,
yeah.
Everyone, Channing, he needs a shirt. He needs to put a shirt
Does
on.
He
he's
though?
Going to space. Come on. You need a shirt in space.
So
sorry, Matt.
He's half wolf. Maybe that's the excuse here.
Yeah, see, but I didn't get that. I missed that.
so while the design is lavish and is inventive and is quite original, the sort of the actual plot and what goes on is not really. This sort of chosen one rags to riches storyline is as old as the hills, and it's got a lot of other stuff from other sci-fi thrown in there. So there's a touch of Soylent Green and of The Matrix, the Wachowskis' highest point in there.
Mm.
There's an extended homage to Terry Gilliam's Brazil in there, the sort of the bureaucratic sequence where she's trying to get her her papers, like her space papers.
Yeah, I know, right? Ellie's not even seen the film, and it's ridiculous already.
I feel like I'm getting the experience right now.
Yeah.
So this is sort of the extended space bureaucracy sequence, and it's an explicit homage to Brazil because Terry Gilliam's actually in it, and she references the 27B/6, which is the important form from Brazil as well. So it does borrow from a lot of stuff. So it is silly. I don't think silly is necessarily a bad thing. I think it is fun silly, this movie. So things can be frustrating silly. I think this was kind of fun for me. It's not as crazy original as I was hoping it would be, but it's kind of fun. It feels like it is attempting to have themes in places. Like I feel like you could try to read in that it has a sort of theme of immigration and statelessness, that sort of she's born in international waters as her mum is illegally immigrating into the US. So she's born without papers, and then you have this extended sequence of her getting her space papers, and the whole thing is about her sort of being legitimized as a sort of a natural citizen of something. But you're really sort of belaboring the point by that point. Though there's also the thing, Channing Tatum is half wolf and he needs a pack, but he was rejected by his pack for being the runt of the litter. So it's all about sort of belonging, and they have that in common, the two leads. But they never really sort of share that feeling between them explicitly in the text, so you really have to read into it to get stuff like that. They are attempting themes, but what they really want in this movie is spaceship chases and Channing Tatum with his shirt off.
Yeah.
And Eddie Redmayne eating all the scenery for all he is worth as a kind of weirdly voiced space accountant.
How weird is his
in
voice?
A crazy sequin jumper with massive sleeves.
I'm sorry, but when he started speaking, I was like, is this for real? Like, what? Why is he talking like that?
It's such a bizarre counterpoint. He's nominated for an Oscar this year. Yeah. For playing Stephen Hawking, and then there is this performance, which is high camp cartoon, like almost like Dune or Zardoz type crazy performance. It's so weird, and he's a sort of an awful space capitalist. So, structure wise, it kind of feels quite episodic. So it's sort of from one thing to the next thing to the next thing, and nothing ever really carries through. So once each set piece is done with, it never really comes back. So she's got these three slimy space relatives, and she has to deal with each one in turn. And each time she is sort of dealing with the political stuff, and her conflict is all internal. And while she is sort of trying to work out whether she's being lied to or doing sort of political negotiations, or deciding whether she ought to marry X or Y for political reasons, and whether it's all a plot, and is very sort of still, and all her conflict is inside, and it's all about sort of the big decisions. During each one of these points, Channing Tatum is off in his spaceship shooting things, or running away from people on his space skates, or being blasted into space. So it's like the action, sort of the internal action from her point of view, is sort of all externalised in his crazy action sequences, which almost don't even need to be there.
Yeah, and they're so long. Oh, my goodness, Matt. The first one where they're in Chicago and she's on his back and it just went on and on.
And it has this problem that modern action cinema kind of has, and it's this Bayhem effect that Michael Bay does as well, where it cuts so fast and from so many different angles that you actually can't really ever get a lock on the geography of the scene, where anything is. So it's almost like every shot you have to see in isolation. You can't really tell, I feel like everyone's in jeopardy because he needs to dodge this thing, because you don't really see the thing coming and where he is in relation to it and all that sort of thing. I think it's worth mentioning that it smashes the Bechdel test.
Yeah, that's true.
And that, like I say, his point, so it could be a Channing Tatum action vehicle. But, like I say, all his action sequences are basically just there to provide counterpoint to all her internal conflict decision points.
Yes.
And it's really her story, and it's about her trying to make the best decision for the largest amount of people with the limited information and outright lies she's given.
I get that. I just don't think that she was a very good character, and I don't think she was a very deep character. I found her very one-dimensional. And all of those spiels that she'd go off onto, where she'd just talk and you'd be like, shut up, stop talking. And he's just standing there looking at her like, I don't know what she's saying. And they're awkward. And she's sort of like vocalizing these things that she feels about him. And he's just like, what? I'm half wolf. I've got these cool skates on.
The dialogue throughout is pretty
dire. It's atrocious.
Especially,
absolutely atrocious.
You get these huge long info dumps of space history from Sean Bean is in it.
Yeah.
Sean Bean is in it. Sean Bean is half B. He shall be known henceforth as Sean B. And he gets all, he, poor guy, gets has to deliver all these huge tranches of, here is what space politics is like, and this is what you're going to have to deal with, and this is why things are the way they are. And it's all sort of, it's not dramatic. It is literally just reeling off almost like the space.
But that's the thing, like,
Wikipedia page.
When she's, sitting there and Channing Tatum's telling her about, he's basically gone, okay, so space is real. There's life on other planets. We killed the dinosaurs. Like, he tells her all this stuff, and she's just like, yep, okay, let's go. I like your arms. We'll just go to space now, yeah? Like, she doesn't even think about it. Like, there's not even... She's not like, oh, I should probably go home and see what Mum's doing. She's like, oh, no, let's just go to space, okay.
Yeah.
And then people start calling her, you know... Am I going to spoil it by saying no one's going to go see this? Surely. Hopefully not.
I don't think it's possible to spoil this movie.
No, people just start calling her Your Majesty.
Yeah.
And she's just like, yeah, I'm queen now.
Queen of space.
Queen of space.
In fact, not even just queen of space, but the genetically reincarnated queen of space.
Yeah, like that was a weird thing. Like, I was sitting there watching this film, just going, this is probably one of the worst things I've ever seen. Like, it was funny, but it wasn't supposed to be funny. And, like, I was laughing in bits that just... I was looking around the cinema and just being like, is everyone serious here? Like, we actually paid for this.
So you're laughing at it, not with
it. I'm laughing at it, not with it. Not with it, no.
So Ellie, based on that raging argument, would you want to go and see this?
I don't think I felt this bewildered for some time. It also, to me, just sounds like someone had a dream. Not like an aspiration, but an actual nighttime sleeping dream. And then they woke up and go, yeah, that'll do. That'll do for that really big film deadline I have. Let's just write all that down and fill it in with faux science. That seems fine.
I would like to make a point, just really quickly, about the fact that I don't like space. That's been mentioned.
And they said space wedding, space police, space everything.
Loads of space. And I've also sort of said that I don't particularly like sci-fi. I don't go out of my way to see sci-fi. I've never seen Star Wars. It's not my thing. I don't think this was sci-fi. I think this was fantasy.
Yeah.
Like, I've never seen much sci-fi, but I'm pretty sure I was...
Sounds like it was pretty heavy on the fi rather than the sci.
Yeah.
Yeah. It was just a complete fantastical, ridiculous film. I mean, like, Elephant Man sitting there driving the plane.
Yeah,
you know?
Space elephant, space dragons, space sort of
again,
rat man.
Like a dream someone had.
Yeah.
Well, I'm not sure if that's going to make people want to go and see the film. Maybe if you've heard our conversation and how ridiculous it was, you'll be slightly intrigued to go and see it.
It sounds like the kind of thing you might want to save and have a silly night in with friends to watch films that are so bad they're good.
Yeah, do that.
The likes
Sharknado. Yeah, Sharknado and Jupiter Descending, which I'm now calling it, because
they're both up there.
Quickly. Okay, thanks, Matt. Any ideas what you're doing? We had a conversation about this. Yeah. Okay.
Next week. I may not have any choice, and this might be karma coming back to bite me for making you go and watch Jupiter Ascending.
Yes.
I don't think there's... nobody is releasing a movie against 50 Shades of Grey, so I can't actually see a screen near me that's showing anything other than that, so I'm going to have to go and see 50
Shades
of Grey.
See, I don't particularly want to go and see it either.
No. Well, I feel like Matt being forced to go and see it is somewhat in tune with the themes of the film, so... You can suffer through that, Matt.
That's
all right,
perfect.
Look forward to that.
Fantastic. All right, that's our film review done for this week. Next up, we are going to listen to an interview about Character, which is coming up. Blackshaw's doing a production called Character. It's been done once before. And Ellie's going to talk to us a little bit about it and introduce the interview that we've got.
Yeah, so I'm not going to give you too much of a lengthy introduction. I will give you all the details about how and where you can go and see it, and indeed when. So the play's called Character. It's by a very talented lady called Florence Vincent, and the basic blurb is, Michelle is about to turn 30 and not coping well. Desperate to finish her first novel before the big 3-0 arrives, she retreats to the countryside with a typewriter, a crate of wine, and her oldest friend Freya, who is harbouring problems of her own. Character is the searingly funny and achingly dark story of two women trying to navigate their way through the modern world and in the process keep their friendship afloat.
Ellie, can you tell me a little bit about Character and what it's about?
Absolutely. So the play is about two characters called Freya and Michelle. They're old friends, and Michelle has decided that before her 30th birthday she wants to try and cross something off the list, which is to write a novel. So she has retreated to the countryside and has invited Freya to come along and whip her into shape and keep her writing. So the play is a lot about procrastination. It's about female relationships, friendships in general, and there's a lot of comedy involved as well.
Angela, could you tell us a little bit about the character of Michelle?
Sure. Michelle is just about to turn 30. And it's having a midlife crisis, objects to it being called a midlife crisis. However, she's having a bit of a meltdown because she feels she hasn't really achieved anything with her life thus far. And so one of her great aspirations is to be a novelist. So she's holed up in a little cottage to try and create this great work, but she's struggling somewhat and is being distracted by booze, old mementos, and any excuse she can find, she tries to delay the actual process.
Claire, can you tell us a little bit about how Freya interacts with Michelle and how she comes into it?
Sure. Well, Freya seems to be much more together on the surface than Michelle is. She's got the job, the nice flat, the boyfriend. And at the start of the play, you think that Freya is, yeah, just much more sorted than Michelle and is there to whip her into shape and sort her out and very much has the upper hand. But as things go on, we see that actually Freya's keeping quite a few secrets and that everything underneath the surface is not quite as perfect as it appeared at first.
Are these characters that you're both playing anything like yourselves in real life?
Yes. It's a short answer for me. Yes, I can see a lot of myself in the character of Michelle. She's neurotic. She has meltdowns on a regular basis and everything is a drama. She's a joy to play, though. She really is. She has no internal filter and she's a big character, which is an absolute joy to perform.
I'd say actually that Freya is very much the opposite to me. I'm much scattier and messier on the surface, but underneath I think thankfully I'm quite a lot more sorted than her and quite a lot happier as well.
So this is the second round of character. Black Shore has done it once before. How is this different, Ellie?
So the run we did last year was as part of the Wandsworth Arts Festival and it was performed at the Selkirk in Tooting. So it was much smaller in scale. Obviously we're at the Tristan Bates this time round. And what we've been trying to do in rehearsals is kind of not just refresh what we've done before, but also inject new life into the play, which has been great fun. So it's been a lot of focus on playing with the text, very relaxed approach, and a lot of organic comedies come out of that, which has been really good fun.
Have you both found this to be completely different to the last run you did, or not?
Well, it's not completely different, because obviously we haven't changed the script at all. We were really happy with it before, and so was Florrie Vincent, the very talented playwright. And there's a lot that just is there in the text to start with, but I'd agree with what Ellie said about coming back to it, playing with it again. We're just having so much fun in rehearsals, and having had a big chunk of time since the last run of it, there's loads of new things that are kind of happening organically this time round. So that's really good. And I can't wait to see what people think of it this time round because they all loved it last time.
How important is it for you both to be working on a production that's all female cast, directed by a female and written by a female person?
It's fabulous. I have to say it's an unusual combination. London Fringe doesn't tend to have that kind of setup. It's great.
I think for me as a director, it's something that a lot of people in the industry will face, is that the majority of scripts have a plethora of exciting roles for men to play and then some side roles for women as a kind of afterthought, or they're there as an accessory to a man. They're the wife of so-and-so, or they're the mistress of so-and-so, and they're more of a kind of operational tool. Whereas in this script, what really excited us as a company was that it's about a relationship between, a friendship between two women, but it really could apply to anyone. It's not gendered. It just so happens that these two characters are female. And really, obviously I'm a female director, and working in an industry where it's easier, I think, for men to have opportunities offered to them, it's important for us to be providing more opportunities for women.
As actresses, do you actively look for roles that are strong female characters?
I have to say, sort of past experience, I have looked more towards classical roles and Shakespearean roles, and sort of just stepping into modern writing. With the classical roles, it's really, if you look at any Shakespeare plays, hardly any female characters. They're the iconic strong ones, and I'm sure Ellie will probably tell you about the casting side of things, that, you know, when females are going up for audition, there's sort of like 200 girls to every one part that's applying, whereas to men it's such a lower ratio of male performers to the part. So It's really exciting to be in a two-hander, female two-hander. I'm not sure that there are that many that exist that you're on stage for that long with that sort of really meaty part to get your teeth into.
I think what's also important is that character is funny and it's engaging, and it's not a play written for women. It's a play that's written for everyone, and everyone will enjoy it. It just so happens to be backed by a team of women, and I think that's a really important kind of gateway production for people getting more women into theatre.
It's not a heavily feminist piece then.
I think the thing about character is it's strong on women and it's feminist for that reason, but it's not political.
It's very much universal themes. So, you know, the core of it is this friendship and how it evolves over time, which is universal. And you know, that point in our lives where we look back and sort of think about what we've achieved and whether we're satisfied with our lot in life. So that's for everyone. And the comedy is definitely for everyone.
Finally, sell character. Why should people go and see this production?
It's an hour long, it's in central London, it's funny, and it's only £10 or £12. That's pretty much the hard sell.
Yeah, all the things Ellie said, but also, yeah, written by a woman, produced by a woman, directed by a woman, performed by women, but for everybody. Come and see us.
Have you ever wondered what crab sticks are made of? If you want to know, come and see the show.
Well, she's absolutely right. If you want to find out how crab sticks are made and their contents, then that is included in the show. It's not a lengthy section, I should point out, so don't let that put you off. So if you want to come and see that show, it's going up from the 9th to the 14th of March. That's a Monday through to Saturday. And it's at the Tristan Bates Theatre in Covent Garden. So it's very central, very accessible. But obviously it's put together by Wandsworth artists. So all you local lovely people, please do come and support.
Our first proper show in a proper, like, big.
Yeah, I would
theater.
Definitely. It's definitely not our first proper show,
obviously.
Having been going for 5 years, thanks, Aisha. No, it is. It does mark a big step for Blackshaw as a company because it's the first, I suppose you could term it, mainstream theatre space in which we're performing. So it is a big commitment, a big step, but it was overwhelmingly. That was the feedback we got from people when we put out a public survey at the end of last year, was we love Blackshaw, please go on to bigger and better things. So this is our first step in that direction, and it's very, very exciting and very, very scary. So we need for it to sell well, and we need for it to be well received. So everyone can help by doing that, by coming along to see it.
Yeah, buying tickets. Yeah. They're on sale.
They are on sale. They're on the Tristan Bates website. So if you go to tristanbatestheatre.co.uk, or if you're old-fashioned, you can give them a phone call and you can book there. And as I say, it's only running for a week. So yeah. Get in there while you can.
Next week, we are going to start a ticket giveaway.
Competition time.
Which is something we've never done before.
No, that was a live jingle that I just did on air there. I hope you like it.
We've recorded this show. It'll make an appearance again,
yeah,
I'm sure.
Yeah, good. Excellent. A slightly creepy whispered singing competition time. I think that's the look we're going for.
Yeah, definitely.
We will be giving away some tickets. You can find out the details on how to apply for those and join the competition next week. But it will be running via Twitter. So we should say we're available now if you want to contact us via Twitter.
Yeah.
We're at Blackshaw Update. You can also find out information about the company at blackshawonline.com. And we're on Facebook as well. So there are lots of ways in which you can interact with us.
Get in touch. Now, thank you, Ellie, for giving us all of the info about character.
That's okay.
Next up, we are hearing from Leslie Strachan, who has spoken to the director of a new production of Arcadia by Tom Stoppard. Now, Tom Morgan will be directing, and he's directing it for the Southside Players in Balham. And here he is speaking with Leslie.
It's a belter. It's funny. It's moving. It's informative. It's tragic. It's got everything you could possibly want from a night at the theatre. The general conceit is that we jump from 1812 or 1809 to modern day, and we jump between the two, and in that jump we see the differences between the way that people live, but the similarities in the way that people are, and actually who these human beings are. And it's just a very human story of love and lust that is told through this guise of a literary detective story where people in the present are investigating the past. And it's just so dynamic in the way that it tells this really interesting, really human story that it, and it, using that story, it presents these really fascinating ideas. So it challenges, but it entertains and it amuses as well. And for me, that is a quintessential night of the theatre.
Now, I've got to say, I'm not a Tom Stoppard fan. So is this the one to make the exception for, or is it, you've got to be a Tom Stoppard fan to like this one?
He often falls into this trap of being very intelligent, and the humanness and the emotion falls flat. In Arcadia, he gets the balance absolutely right. It's his perfectly constructed souffle of emotion and intellectualism. And you get all the ideas, you get all the science and the literature and the arguments and the words that Stoppard loves, but you also get the really poignant love and emotion and connections between human beings and people messing up and making mistakes and people getting things wrong and all these really human characters who come together to tell this story and express these ideas. So for me, absolutely, it's the exception. It's
okay. Now, you mentioned the word poignant. I understand this could be a poignant production for the Southside Players. It might be the last production in the premises.
It is, yes. So we've performed in the Chestnut Grove School in Balham on Boundaries Road, and it is being redeveloped. So we are homeless. It is the last show there. We've been there for the best part of 10, 15 years, I think. And it's been a very good home to us. But we have to look on to pastures new. But this is our last hurrah. The guy who's designing our set is a professional Hollywood set dresser. He's pulled out all the stops, and all our lighting designers, all our tech crew are really excited about really pushing this space as far as it can go for one last time. So it's a celebration of the space, but it's also quite a poignant thing in that we don't have a home anymore. But we're looking, we're going to stay in Balham. We want to be, we're very local. Part of our ethos and our identity is local. And all our membership is local. We're passionate about the area, want to be in the area. But we are looking for a new home, and we will find one, I'm sure. But this is our last hurrah.
That was our arts news correspondent here on Wandsworth Radio, Leslie Strachan, speaking with Tom Morgan, who is directing Arcadia by Tom Stoppard for the Southside Players in Balham. Now, this particular production is playing from Wednesday the 18th to Friday the 20th of February at 7:30, and then there's a 5 p.m. showing on the Saturday the 21st. At the Chestnut Grove Theatre in Balham. And tickets are £10, concession is £7.50. And to buy tickets, you need to go to www.southsideplayers.org.uk. Ellie, have you ever seen Arcadia? I've not.
I actually directed a production of Arcadia when I was at university. It was kind of cutting my teeth, actually. It was the first full show that I directed, and it's, I would really recommend going to see it. It's a fantastic show.
Yeah. See, I find it. So Tom Stoppard, explain who Tom Stoppard is to
well,
me.
Tom
is he
Stoppard's,
quite famous?
He's a very well-renowned playwright,
yeah.
And he's still writing, and he's got a new play actually coming up at the National Theatre, A Hard Problem, which I'm going to see on the 24th, so I'll be talking about that on this show.
Oh, cool. Oh, intersecting. Mm. We intersect so well. Now coming up, we are going to play a little bit of poetry. We've done poetry before on the show, mostly from Owen Collins, and we're going to play a few of his pieces. The first one that we're playing is called The Risk of Risk.
This is about the board game Risk, which I enjoy a lot. I don't know if any of you listening play Risk. It's a board game, and it's a map of the world that's divided into several territories, a lot of which have got slightly dubious names, like Yakutsk. And you get a certain amount of territories to start off with, and you basically have to conquer the world. And the best bit isn't the actual playing, it's the making alliances with other players against other players, and just generally creating all-around bad feeling. And you have to set aside a few hours after each game of Risk to just sort of sit in silence and repair your friendships, because everyone will be too furious with each other to actually talk or do anything. I played a game of Risk in 2011 with a friend of mine called Luke, and we're still not quite as friendly as we were before that, ever since he betrayed me in East Congo. But that's fine, you live and learn. But yeah, played it with my girlfriend a few times, often with my family as well. And as much as I love my girlfriend, and I should clarify this now, when I play Risk with the girlfriend, I have a horrible habit of going for her first. And I don't know why. Maybe it's because she knows my weaknesses and I need to get her out of the game. And often I will sort of form an alliance with my brother, and we will together wipe her out quite quickly. Like, my mum's fine, because my mum is a very ineffectual player who doesn't really know what she's doing, so we can leave her till the end. But yeah, we have to get rid of my girlfriend first. So this is a poem about how... it's called The Risk of Risk, and it's just about how sort of the relationship-destroying powers of the game Risk. The Risk of Risk. I love you, really, my darling, my dear, though that doesn't mean I'll give you Siberia. I fear our relationship as mutual lovers may be undermined by my alliance with my brother. It's nothing personal, we're just trying to keep you out of Central Africa. And after that, I promise I'll attack him with all my horses to win you back, because to me, you see, you're all that matters. Although Ural and Yakutsk, they're mine, okay? And I know I would be a romantic failure if I didn't let you have Western Australia. I know you'd return the presents I gave you if I'm not your saviour in Scandinavia. Thing is, my number of troops is limited, and if I conquer North America, I get an extra 5. So it's worth wiping you out to keep my dreams alive of territorial expansion. And when I rule the continents, I'll buy you a mansion, and all the cannons in Asia couldn't keep us apart. And I'll roll a 6 to launch a cavalry charge on your heart.
That was a poem called The Risk of Risk by Owen Collins. I've never played Risk, so it doesn't really apply to me, that poem. But this one sort of does and sort of doesn't, and it's called Lay-By.
Lay-By. Down the trunk road, past the verge, where the traffic starts to merge, let me be your concierge in the lay-by, baby. Give the car behind the slip where the truckers have their kip, and the cabbies spend their tip in the lay-by, baby. A curve of tarmac for no reason, sometimes with traffic policing. They sell strawberries in the season from the lay-by, baby. Fend off narcolepsy attacks with a range of tepid snacks, a burger and a Pepsi Max from the lay-by, baby. Have a brief romantic sortie down the side of the A40. Take the keys out and be naughty in the lay-by, baby. Any old excuse to skive off, stop the wipers, turn 5 live off. A bit of fun before we drive off from the lay-by, baby. Undo seatbelt, help with yours while outside the traffic roars. Put your seat back, lock the doors, and be my lay-by baby.
Now, I say that that poem sort of doesn't really apply to me, because until I actually listened to it quite intently, I didn't know what a lay-by was.
Yeah, I think you might have been slightly misleading by saying that it was or wasn't relatable for you. The naughty bits weren't what Aisha was referring to there. But no, in Australia, the word lay-by is not utilised in that scenario.
In that sense, no. Not as a place where you park on a, I'm assuming, like a motorway?
Well, yeah, it's used sort of as a generic area to the side of the road where you can pull over if your car break down or if you need
to... had like a sleepy or something.
Yeah, something
yeah.
like that.
See, that area in Australia is where we sort of push, where all the dead animals that get hit by
yeah.
trucks get pushed
yeah.
to.
Cool. So, do you call it something weird or?
No, I don't think it has a name actually.
Okay, well, we were postulating that Australia is so big and vast that any kind of area to the side of the road is just going to be a vast expanse of, yeah. of land. Of whereas all. In the UK, any area to the side of the road is kind of precious and utilised. So
we need to give it a name, this piece of land. It must be named.
Yeah.
Well, the next poem we've got coming up is by a new poet to the Blackshore Arts Hour. Her name is Daisy Thurston Ghent, and she's fantastic. And I recorded her doing poetry for the show this morning, in fact. And
oh, box fresh.
Yeah, it's super fresh. That's weird. I shouldn't say that.
You said it like you were trying to be Will.i.am,
yeah.
which made you sound like kind of middle-aged woman, but that's fine. We'll let it happen.
I'm not middle-aged.
No, I said like a middle-aged dear. Woman.
Oh, well, anywho. So I'm playing this poem on the show today because I've given Space a really hard time and I feel a little bit bad because I've got a lot of friends who really love Space. Like, that's just the thing that they love. I once made my friend a Space t-shirt because he loves Space so much. And it's just not my bag. I don't get it. But this is a really great poem that makes me like Space just a little bit.
A 6-year-old boy with two fingers up his nose, knows more about space than I do. Stood across his stabilizer push bike like it's the Harley Davidson he used to ride across the Milky Way. He's full of facts that make my head explode. While I tend to spend a lot of time just looking up, in total wonderment, puzzled by my own magnificent insignificance to the excellence of the universe, I am not a necessary element. In fact, I barely make a dent. But I'll wander to the ends of this levitating, unbreakable gobstopper in the mouth of something far greater, and when the Earth's exploded us to particles, spun off its axis like a spinning top, I know the friends who will join me in the electric race through the mains, fast-tracked to the heart, molecules dissolved into my bloodstream, tiny iron filings. Someone once told me that everyone you love who's passed away someday becomes the face in the moon's craters. For years, I'd lay awake at sleepovers, tell my friends, you know, that man in the moon was my dad. And I'd lose a lot of sleep that way. These days, I sit on sunken sofas with friends in drunken stupors who say the universe is so empty. A sentence that perplexed me. Still they vent, shout their mouths off at the solar system, nothing matters, they're pissed off at the planets. Stick up two fingers to the sun, they're jealous of the stars, because even though they die off fast, they still get to burn fiercely. Me, well, I've got plenty of friends I'd waste wishes on. I'm scared they'll burn out just as quickly, and yeah, some days my insignificance makes me sickly, but there's a greatness in being small and humanly. You know, Jupiter has four moons that all look like speckled mini eggs. And who else can make that analogy but we, the human beings? So you'll find me forever hunting in the garden, on my knees like a child at Easter, just trying to make sense of this existence. But no one howls to the moon these days, do we? These days it's all phone calls and mic stands and Siri, and I'm seriously considering the myriads of blinking luminaries that make light of bigger things. They don't care how bright the days get. They know the night is always dark, and still they never douse, not even for a moment. I know so little of this universe. But still, I play my part as ignorant human, taking nothing but small steps. Downplaying my greatest achievements is a leap forward in a race I sometimes don't even believe in. I don't remember agreeing to take part, complain of false starts and fixes that put me off my game, making bets on my behalf. I tell this kid, if I amount to even half a star, I'll be satisfied. And he looks confused, unable to challenge me through facts about Mars and spatial physicality. He doesn't think of human practicality, right? He doesn't need to. I tell him not to lose his spirit, and he says he must get home for dinner. And then he rides into a sunset that he wholly understands. When I was his age, we'd sing, he's got the whole world in his hands, he's got the whole wide world in his hands. I seem to spend a lot of time looking up. Remind me next time. I need to show you something.
That was a lovely poem that's untitled as yet.
Ooh.
By Daisy Thurston Ghent. My sound man who recorded it for me this morning has titled it Man in the Moon, which I quite like. So I'm going to put that to Daisy.
Yeah, Daisy is always searching for titles, so I'm sure she'll be pleased for a good suggestion.
Now, Daisy, I heard about Daisy the first time, and the reason that I recorded her is because I saw her at a Blackshaw New Writing Night, same as Owen Collins.
Mm-hmm.
And it's such a nice... Especially, like, poetry works really well on our show because we are theatre, we are arts, we do a lot of reviews and stuff, and it breaks up a show really nicely, I think. I've been saying to people, I want more poetry because it's essentially a song for our arts show. And I think it works in the same way at a new writing night because it's mostly new writing, it's mostly theatre, and then you chuck those little bits of poetry in and it gives a performance. Like, they're so energetic, these poets. I've never been to a poetry slam, but I really think I should go to one.
Yeah, I mean, the way that we use it in Black Shore programming for New Writing Nights is often, I mean, obviously depending on the content of the poems, but as you say, they're often energetic performances, they're very sort of revitalising, so I often see them like a kind of sorbet in between meals of what can be quite heavy theatre.
Yeah.
So they're a really fantastic way to break up the programming and keep the audience really engaged. And meeting people like Daisy and Owen through the New Writing Nights is an absolute joy, and it's such a fantastic way for us to build our network even further. So what I'm going to talk to you about now is the New Writing Nights, how they work, how people can take part in those. So feel free to interject with questions, Aisha. And
I will.
Talk on behalf of the general public whenever I say something that makes no sense. So we set up the New Writing Nights right at the beginning of Black Shore's life as a way to keep ourselves creatively active without having to commit to a long-term rehearsal period, and also a way to meet lots of new creative people in London because we were all new to the city. So the way they work is that every other month we have a New Writing Night. Submissions are open to anyone, anytime, 24/7. And we, about 3 weeks before each New Writing Night date, we go through our submissions and we select pieces based on what will make a good programme for the evening and which pieces we think will really benefit from development and feedback at the New Writing Nights. Question?
Who selects the pieces? Do you select them yourself, or do you have another person within Black Shore who does that?
So the submissions themselves are monitored by our lovely web manager, Richard Stratton, and he makes sure people have filled out the submissions form correctly and that kind of thing. And the completed submissions all get sent to myself and Nicole, who's our lovely New Writing Night manager, who does all the administration for the night, and also to Vicky Weston, who's our strategy and planning. She's our strategy and planning manager. And anyone else on the Black Shore team who's interested that time round can read the pieces as well.
Okay.
So it's very much a kind of committee decision as to which pieces to include. And we, you know, if we've just had a huge amount of applications and we've got, say, three times as many suitable applications as the night will allow us to perform, we'll often contact writers and say, we don't have room this time, but can we roll your piece over for selections for the next one?
Mm-hmm.
So, you know, don't be put off if your piece doesn't get staged straight away. Keep sending in new and different things, and we might keep what you've sent on the back burner as well.
Okay. Kind of like you sort of collecting people's CVs.
Yeah, kind of, I guess, yeah. But instead it's something they've worked really hard on that's, you know, part of themselves.
Hey, I worked hard on my CV.
Of course, no, I'm not downplaying the excitement and work that goes into CVs. But yeah, when it's a play or poetry, I think it's really personal to people. So we try to be as welcoming and as efficient and as reassuring to people as possible. It's not a scary process. People, you know, if we say no thank you, we don't give you some kind of horrible rundown and full on criticism of what you've sent in. That's not what we're about. It's about providing a supportive and creative atmosphere to engender development of work. So we don't just take submissions of theatre writing, it's worth pointing out. We take poetry, music sometimes, comedy sketches, so if there's, or stand-up comedy if there's people on the circuit wanting to try new stuff out. It's a really good way to get immediate feedback from the audience because of the way we run our evenings.
Yeah, I think that's the best thing about Black Shore, because you are so organized and it is very much the audience is there to help out the person who's written the piece and also give feedback to the actors or you know, whatever you want to do in your feedback, you can do that, and Black Shore gives you all the tools, including pens.
Yes,
it's
including
fantastic.
Pens. So on the night itself, how it works is we sandwich each piece with a short feedback interval. So that's sort of 5-10 minutes where we invite the audience to give feedback, either by writing it down on a feedback form, which then gets taken away and typed up, so it's anonymous, and that can be feedback on the piece itself, so the writing or the acting or the directing. And then that gets sent to all participants of each piece within a week or so of the event itself. But you can also give feedback if you don't fancy writing things down by talking into a recording device that Black Shore team members circulate with during the evening. So then the actors, directors, writers performing all get sent an MP3 file of their audio feedback as well.
Yeah, it's a fantastic system. And if anything, you should come and see the Black Shore team in our Black Shore t-shirts.
We do look pretty snazzy. They were our first kind of big purchase, and the logo is embroidered and everything.
Oh,
so it's
luxury.
It's worth coming just to see those. In terms of the kind of programme that we run for the New Writing Nights, they are every other month, but this coming New Writing Night is on the 25th of March, and that is what we're referring to as our short... it's really hard to say. Our showcase shortlist. And the showcase shortlist is essentially a New Writing Night where we take submissions from people who are only submitting theatre for that round, and we then shortlist them. They get performed at this special New Writer Night in March, and the winner of that night, which again is selected by the Blackshaw Committee, goes on to work with Blackshaw for the rest of the year and have their play produced as a full-length industry showcase in January of the following year, so in January 2016.
So and you get a whole year to work with Blackshaw.
Yeah, so it means people can submit... They could submit a whole play that they've written, and it's not been, as long as it's not been staged before, and obviously they'd submit a 10-minute section of that. And then we'd go on to sort of look at the existing script and see whether they wanted to tweak things, have workshops with actors, we could provide writing mentors. Or they can send in, you know, a really short extract of something that they've not developed anything else around it, just this very short piece. And then we work with them to help them through the writing process, which is what happened with last year's winner,
yeah.
Kat Roberts. She'd submitted a very short kind of 7-minute section, which was performed at the shortlist event. And we worked with her over the coming months to develop it into a full-length script, which was performed in January of this year.
And it was fantastic. So, I mean, the track record is only 1 year so far, but it's fantastic.
It
because
is.
It's being able to create something from, you know, with in a, such a collaborative environment, I think, is another great thing that Blackshaw offers with this particular showcase shortlist. That's happening on the 25th of March. Submission yeah. deadline.
So submission deadline for that is the 6th of March, and you can see all of the submission deadlines for all of the year's New Writing Nights on our website if you just go to blackshawonline.com. So if you want to be considered for the showcase shortlist, then the 6th of March is the deadline. But if you want to just send your writing in, if it's not theatre or if it is theatre but you're not sure it's ready for that yet, then you can send it in and we'll be considering it for the next one, which will be in May.
Which is the Wandsworth Arts Festival.
That's
one,
correct.
Which is another sort of different-y sort
well,
of...
Well, it's going to be the same setup, just at a different
just
venue.
Just in a different venue.
Yeah, so we normally do our nights at the Horse and Stables, which is just by Waterloo Station. Mm. But for the Wandsworth Arts Festival, we'll be doing our main new writing night at the Selkirk in Tooting, and it will be a big focus on Wandsworth participants. So if you live in Wandsworth, then if you're writing, if you're acting or directing and you want to get involved, that's the one for you. And as I say, applications are open all the time, and that's not just for the writing, that's for the acting and the directing as well. We put all of our acting is advertised via Casting Call Pro, which is an online website for actors, and those calls go out a few weeks before each event happens, so you can apply that way, and it's always advertised via our newsletter. So if you sign up to that on our website, then you'll be sure to get a notification in your inbox to let you know that there's opportunities.
Yeah, so get in contact with us because we want your writing and we want to produce your plays.
We do.
And theatre.
That is what we want to do.
Speaking of the theatre, Ellie.
Yes.
We went to the theatre on Friday.
We did.
Oh, seamless. We went and saw Great Expectations, which if you were listening to the show last week, you would know that we were going to see because we interviewed Marcus, the director, and Rupert, who was the main lead. He played Pip, as the main character. This is a really quick review that one of our Blackshaw
associates
has recorded for us. This is a review of Great Expectations by Alexander Pankhurst.
Having never read the book before, most of my knowledge of the story has been gleaned from my mother, random bits of film, and South Park, so, safe to say, I had a mixed understanding of the story. On that note, Cyphers have adapted the story of Great Expectations directly from the text. And by that, I mean that they have only used Dickens's words. No small feat, as director Marcus Baisley told me, that meant cutting down 12 hours of spoken text to just under 2. Set in the round, and using minimal light, sound, props and costume, it forced the audience to use their imagination much more. However, that is not to say it was a difficult watch, quite the opposite. The actors' fluid movement and the seamless way in which they used boxes and the occasional chair to set the scene were so smoothly choreographed that you were swept from one scene to another beautifully. Coupled with the narration, scenes were set, collapsed and reset and again in the blink of an eye, giving the whole piece a very tight, sure feel. This left me in no doubt that I was in the hands of a very competent company. I mentioned before about the narration. All the actors narrate the voice of Pip, including the main character in question, and all of the actors, bar Pip, multi-role. This style of narration meant that I engaged with all of the actors much more, and I found that it meant that I engaged with the piece much more as a whole. Such was the skill of the actors that instead of the multi-rolling becoming a distracting competition of who can do the most accents, it enforced the immersive quality of the show, and I think to individually name names would distract, or rather detract, from the great ensemble cast that they were. It is a shame that it is not going on for longer, as I think it was an incredibly enjoyable 2 hours spent in the company of some really great performers. My hat goes off to all involved at Cyphers for bringing one of the great literary classics to life, and I look forward to seeing what they do next.
That was a review of Great Expectations, which was playing last week. It finished up today, actually, at the Proud Archivist in Haggerston. Ellie and I went along to see it with a couple of other Blackshaw people. It was a really nice evening. And it was, because I'd spoken to Marcus quite a lot about it during the interview, I sort of knew what I was in for, and I knew that it was going to be something that I had to really engage with. And I was a little bit worried going in, because I thought, what if I'm not in the mood? And I wasn't in the mood, because I didn't really get the first 10 minutes, because it was so quick. I was like, I don't know what's going on. And I was super worried that I wasn't going to understand the entire play.
Did you feel some pressure because Marcus had said the audience will need to use their imagination?
Yes.
I thought, Marcus, mine's
not very good. Oh. That's why I asked him those questions last week, because I was like, well, not so much if the audience completely rejects the style of theatre that they're doing. What if the audience just isn't smart enough? And I was worried that I wasn't quite intelligent enough to be able to understand something as immersed, not immersive, but something that I had to be active in and engaged with, and also, on the other end of the spectrum, I'd not read the book, and I had no idea about what the story was.
So you didn't know the story at all?
Not at all.
Oh, that's interesting. Okay.
Yeah. And, I mean, they did a fantastic job, because I understood everything.
That's really good.
Aside from, you know, the first initial couple of minutes, because it was just really quick. And I wasn't ready.
Yeah, I think with those kind of pieces, when they're quite stylized in their presentation, you need to kind of almost tune into the language that they're using.
Definitely.
So I find that with accents.
Yeah.
If I hear a very thick Glaswegian accent, for example, for the first couple of seconds, I'm like, I don't understand. Is this English? And then your ear tunes into it. And I think it's the same with theatre. You kind of go, oh, these are the rules and parameters that are being set by this performance. Now I understand what's happening.
I think it's definitely an adjustment to normal theatre, because normal theatre, you're, you know, sitting in the dark and you're in a chair and
it's all very comfortable.
Yeah, very, very comfortable. And this was not that.
Yeah. And I think actually it's quite interesting that you said normal theatre, you know, you're sitting in a chair, it's in the dark, and you feel very safe, don't you? Because there's a very clear line of light that defines you and the performers, and they're on the stage and you're in the seats.
Mm.
But with this production and with other productions that I've really loved, you aren't, there's no definite clear line. It's you're involved in the production without having to be kind of a participant as such. We were seated in the semi-round and the lights flooded the whole space, not just, you know, a defined stage space, so they performed it in promenade around us, and I think that was really fantastic. And I think, like you say, you kind of tune into that and then you go, oh, okay, now I'm comfortable, I understand what's happening. But I think as a result of that type of performance, you are much more engaged in the action than you would be, and far less removed from the action that you than you are when there's a really clear fourth wall between you and the performance.
And I think in saying that, Mark, in knowing what Marcus wanted to do and how he wanted that to be received by an audience, completely won everything. I mean, they were so on point. I mean, the performances by all of the cast were fantastic, and I think they really achieved what they set out to achieve. And I'd love to see them do something else. I'm not sure if I should say this on the radio, but I was talking to Marcus at the bar afterwards, and my partner and I were talking about what they're doing next, and he said Jane Eyre, maybe.
Ooh, exciting.
And I said, if you can make me like Jane Eyre, Marcus, then you win.
And I bet he will, actually.
Yeah, no, of course, because I mean, coming from not having read any Dickens and then really liking and potentially maybe wanting to read some Dickens.
Well, I think if he's made people want to read it, then that is true success.
Yeah,
that's
really exactly
good.
But yeah, Jane Eyre. Ugh,
yeah.
That's,
well,
a tough one.
I think definitely look out for what Cyphers are doing, and maybe they'll do another run of Great Expectations. And
yeah.
if they do, everyone should go and see it.
definitely go and check out what they're doing, because it's really interesting. That's all we got time for on the show. That's gone quickly.
It has gone speedy.
Yeah, this is our fifth Black Show Arts Hour, and
I should have brought a cake.
Oh,
never mind.
I wish we had cake.
Maybe for the 10th one, I'll bring cake.
Okay. Yeah, cool.
But not like on the studio desk or anything like that. If you're listening, Jason and Matt,
we're not going to eat cake in the studio. No. Next week on the show, if you'd like to tune in, we will be doing a bit more poetry. We're probably going to be doing more theatre, I suppose, because that's kind of what we do. We'll be playing you new Writing Night pieces. We'll play Wailing Well
for
the second time, which is exciting. And so tune in next week, 6 till 7 on a Sunday. I've been Aisha, and Ellie.
I've been Ellie.
You have been Ellie.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, Ellie, yes. You need to tell us about character before we leave.
Okay, so it's the 9th to the 14th of March at the Twist and Bates Theatre. You can book tickets via their website. They're only £12, and it's going to be fantastic, and we'll be giving away tickets next week. Yes. So tune in, 6 till 7 on Sunday.